focus, I think.
They could. Yeah. Well, you're the marketer, so you would know.
Yeah. Well, I'm a big fan of him. Yeah, I'm a bit. The other thing I think. Hello and welcome to episode 158 of the Rockstar CMO Effing Marketing Podcast. I'm your host, Ian Trusker. I'm no rockstar, but on this weekly podcast, I chat with the true rockstars, my fabulous guests and chums that I've met on my journey from techie to CMO, sharing their marketing street knowledge in a show that Jason Falls described as a variety show for marketers. Come say hello. We are Rockstar CMO on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'll include links to me, my guests, and all the things we talk about in the show notes on rockstarcmo.com. And we are proud members of the Marketing Podcast Network. It's Saturday the 18th of March. Thank you for joining us. Hope you've had a good week and you are well and staying as sane as you feel you need to be. My regular guest, Jeff Clark, is still on holiday. So like last week, I'll take a deeper dive with a longtime industry chum. And this week is Teresa Regley, Director and Chief Strategist at Vox Veritas Digital, to geek out on digital asset management. And then I'll wind down the week with Robert Rose in the Rockstar CMO virtual bar for a cocktail and a marketing thought. But first, we need to pay the bar tab. I'll be back in a moment.
We'll be right back.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Heiler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcasts.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
On to our first segment. I've probably known Teresa Regley for around 20 years. And in my mind, she is the foremost expert on digital asset management. As you'll hear, she wrote what I think is a definitive book on the topic and has helped over 300 companies with their digital asset and media management strategies, technology acquisitions and implementations, and has authored extensive research on over 50 vendors in this space. As a B2B technology marketer, I'm fortunate to get to spend time with Teresa as a friend, and I find her straight-talking insight as an analyst invaluable. I think that comes across in our chat. I really hope you enjoy this conversation. Welcome, Teresa, to Rockstar CMO FM. How are you?
I am fantastic. How are you, Ian?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. And people listening to your accent would think that maybe you're somewhere far away in Philadelphia or something like that, but you're right there in London, aren't you, today?
I am Greenwich. I am a Greenwich girl now. I am very close to the prime meridian where time begins. Indeed.
Because we own time, right? Anyway, for people, I just dive straight into it, Tree, because we're old friends, good friends.
Yes.
But for people that don't have that pleasure of meeting you for a Spanish tapas every now and again, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Teresa Regley, and mm-hmm. I've been working in digital technology for almost 30 years now. I started with hand coding websites for newspapers in Boston back in the mid 90s. Yeah. And eventually that became working with early stage content management systems and then eventually digital asset management systems. And I worked as an implementer. I ran a content management team at an SI for about 6 or 7 years. And then I became an analyst in the space, wrote lots of voluminous reports on content management systems, digital asset management systems. And then I went independent, focused on MarTech and DAM since 2016.
Wow. Has it been that long? Wow. That's fantastic.
Yes, it has.
And your firm is called Vox Veritas, right?
So what is it? Vox Veritas Digital, to be specific. That's okay. That's okay. it's always, you know, good to have a shorter version. Yeah, it's a voice of truth in digital. That was mm-hmm. that was the idea. It's also meant to be a play on, actually, I studied linguistics and I took 5 years of Latin. So The idea of old language and words are very important to me. So the, the Latin voice of truth in digital was meant to be a bit of a, almost an ironic oxymoron in some ways. But yeah, it was just the name that came to me at the time.
I love it. And also that history of the old school hand coding and stuff. That's we have a lot of parallels there in where you came from. But right now, your specialism is digital asset management. And in fact, you wrote the book on digital asset management, didn't you?
I guess you could call it the book. There's been a few books on DAM, but it's definitely the biggest and the longest one. I did. I wrote it in 2016. It was kind of it was sort of the swan song on my last role, my last company, and it really helped catapult my new business. But yes, it's a book called Digital and Marketing Asset Management, and it's all about the technology and practice of DAM.
Exactly. Yeah. And what you do at the moment is, well, I know you as just the go-to person for digital asset management, right? So you, like I say, you wrote the book, you've been doing this for a long time. And so what do you do at the moment? You help people implement digital asset management solutions, select them. What's the general thing you're doing every day?
The main thing I do is I help people define a North Star for digital asset management and then figure out how to get there. And if you actually, if you look at the logo for Vox Veritas Digital, there's a star in the middle of the O, and that is really intentional, because people who and organizations, large enterprises, all kinds of sizes that I work with, they're often in a stage where they want to understand what's possible, and I try very, very hard to make sure that there is a full understanding of all the possibilities with my clients, and then help them decide, well, where do I want to go? And then at a very tactical level, because at the core, I am a technologist. I say this all the time. I'm not a marketer. I'm a technologist. I help them figure out what do they need to get there. So that might involve technology selection. That might involve change management. It might involve a new data strategy. It could involve lots of different things, but it's where do you want to go and how do we get there? That's pretty much what I do.
I love your view on marketing, and we'll get to that in a moment, because I'm wondering where this conversation is going to go, because I know that over a glass of wine, we've had the occasional robust conversation about marketers and marketing.
Indeed we have.
So I'm looking forward to that. So let's start with, I mean, I would imagine the listener probably knows what a digital asset manager is, but Why didn't marketers need to think about this? Why would we want to work? Oh, by the way, sorry, just one quick question. What sort of organizations do you actually work with? What do your clients look like?
Yeah, I would say the lion's share of my client base is large consumer products companies, and that's been the dominant clients of mine for the last decade. I've worked with Unilever a very long time. One of my largest clients now is Flowers Foods, which if you're in the States, you would recognize brands such as Dave's Killer Bread, Wonder Bread. They're one of the largest bakers, in the country. So they sell all kinds of companies that sell consumer goods. So that's the lion's share. But then I also work with a lot of performing arts organizations, museums, especially here in the UK, a lot of cultural heritage organizations. That's sort of my soft spot, because I love the arts and I love performance and theater. So it's sort of those two opposite ends of the spectrum. And then I would say there's a little bit that I do that's almost not DAM, which is I do help a lot of services companies in the DAM space with figuring out how they can better service companies and better implement DAM companies. So I also advise some CEOs on growth strategy and things like that.
No, you've got a great customer set and you really varied. But why is it that people come to you? What do marketers, well, I mean, specifically because this is a marketing show, so I'm going to focus on marketers, but why do marketers need to think about managing digital assets?
Well, I like to say that digital asset management is kind of the unsexy foundational engine for marketing. So I think as someone who's not a marketer, it's very easy for me to just remove myself from all of these ambitious marketing ideas and campaigns and all these, awesome metaverse approaches that everyone's talking about now. And I'm just extremely practical. So DAM is important for marketers because if you do not have a foundational source of truth for your marketing assets that is well enriched with metadata, you are not going to be able to do all these amazing marketing campaigns that you're dreaming about. It just won't work. So it's sort of the plumbing, you know, it's the plumbing underneath everything that is important. And that's what marketers need to think about.
I completely agree. I mean, throughout my content management career, I was at Vignette 20 years ago and we were talking about personalization. When I would talk about personalization, we were always very focused on understanding our customer, but we didn't spend a lot of time understanding our content. So if you know everything about your customer and you know what they want, how can you deliver that to them if you don't understand your content, right?
That's right. It's very important. And fortunately, I think that's finally changed now. I think we actually are looking to understand our content and, of course, how effective our content is, which is perhaps the most important thing to marketers, right? So, and I think that's about when I met you, wasn't it, 20 years ago when you were working?
Probably at a Gilbane conference or something like that.
Yes, I think so.
So, and whereas traditionally, I think that most people think of some people think about digital asset management as just, oh, it's the place where all the pictures and the videos and stuff go. Like, it's almost like a shared drive or something in the cloud where everything goes. But from what you're saying there, and particularly with our experience with things like personalization and delivery, it seems to be evolving. What are you seeing with your clients in DAM actually evolving to be more part of that sort of system of engagement?
Yeah, it's ecosystem is the word I use. It's part of a much bigger ecosystem and it is now much more a service. I like to use the term, and I'm somewhat disappointed that it hasn't caught on like wildfire. I like to say DAM as a service. There's still a mentality of thinking of a DAM as, you know, to your point, it's like I'm a marketer or I'm an archivist or I'm a picture manager, and I go into a DAM. I physically go to a browser and I log into it, and I'm doing stuff with my imagery. But now it's much more about I'm a digital experience platform, and I am dynamically looking to pull a digital asset that is customized and dynamically personalized for this particular advertisement that's going to be delivered to my mobile device. So it's much more dynamic, it's much more conversational, it's much more intelligent, and it is essentially providing content for the intelligence layer and the personalization layer.
Right. So, and it's funny because Kathy McKnight, she was on the show last week, and we were talking about DXC and DXP, digital experience, and we were talking about composability and stuff. It sounds like DAM now sits right in that, right? In that when we talk about sort of composable stacks and headless and stuff, that your DAM is actually connected right into those digital experience platforms that we would have that would do that delivery. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think unfortunately, the DAM vendor marketplace has been slower to embrace composability. The technology is not as advanced and composable as the front end of the stack and the DXPs of the world. And you know, as we look at the vendors that are in the experience layer, they have to be they've been quicker to move to that. But indeed, when it comes to the whole digital experience stack, going all the way back, you know, going upstream, absolutely. And I see DAM vendors definitely evolving their systems to be a part of that.
Right. So you're seeing these DAM systems being part of what I would say, in the direct line of delivery for the consumer, so that if somebody is on their mobile device, they're looking at an image and looking at the very latest image, it'll come directly from the DAM rather than it being pushed out to a web content management solution or something like that. Where you think DAM's heading?
It could be, but I like to think of it less of a place and more to my point earlier, more like it's a service. So there is something that is serving something to you on your phone. And that is probably calling on various systems, dynamic, or it might be that digital asset might be cached, somewhere. It might be a reference. The DXP or the CMS might be referencing a URL in your DAM, but you're not necessarily looking at the DAM necessarily as a consumer. There's so many different ways to technically achieve it, but it's usually still one once removed. The dam is still usually once removed from the consumer, but it's got a lot to do with that delivery now, making sure the delivery has the right asset.
Yeah. And we as industry watchers and analysts and vendors tend to be on these sort of edge cases, the most exciting thing that you can do with dam. Are you actually seeing these as use cases now? Or where do you see your customers' maturity? Are they primarily still trying to assemble their assets together and get their metadata sorted out so at least they've got a library? Or do you see people actually taking these steps of it being part of the experience?
It is so dramatically across a massive spectrum, Ian, I can't even tell you. I mean, I'll give you two examples of clients. You know, I have one client that just launched their first dam. You know, they are a giant, you know, multi-billion-dollar company, but they never had a dam until 2 months ago. Okay, so huge, and this is the first for them. They're also launching their first PIM. So they've been much lower or slower, I should say, or further down the digital transformation curve. You know that, and that's okay. They're moving into that. But then yesterday, here in London, I was meeting with a client where I met with their, this is, was his title, Vice President of Creative Artificial Intelligence.
Wow.
Okay, that's quite a title, right? And you know, he was incredibly brilliant, super intelligent, you know, very much focused on innovation. And we were talking about DAM, and he said, I know I need a DAM to do all the things I want to do.
Wow.
You know, and so to hear somebody with that sort of title, they're already doing this particular company. They're already doing all kinds of incredibly innovative things. But they want a DAM as an enabler underneath all that. So this is two totally opposite ends of the spectrum. So I see it all across, you know, all across different levels of maturity all across the board.
I love seeing those use cases because it's really delivering on the promise of, I'm more of a content management person than a digital asset management person, but it's the same. It's delivering on that same promise, isn't it? That we're smartly tagging our content. We understand our content. It becomes intelligent, and then we can use it in these these great use cases, in these great ways. To
build absolutely, and I think can I make one point? This is as a thought to that. Oh. I think it's so important. That we and I imagine some of the people that are listening to this will be other consultants, other industry watchers. I think it's very important that we meet our clients where they are, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, and we don't have the expectation that, you know, that company that I talked about that just launched their first DAM and their first PIM, that they're suddenly going to be building metaverse applications tomorrow. Right. Yeah. So I and that's part of the wonderful thing about diversity of working with different organizations. Right. I think it's an important thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And what I was going to move on to with my selfish B2B marketer's hat on was to ask you about, about vendors. And I think that point is a good segue into that, because it's the same with the vendors, isn't it? Is that often we're sort of thinking about the latest thing, the latest analyst conversation, the latest thing in the zeitgeist, all our features and functions, and yet we forget perhaps the basic problem that the client's sometimes trying to solve, and we think that's kind of dull, so we don't talk about it or write about it, but that's the thing that people are really interested in sometimes.
Yep, I think you make it's a superb point. And I mean, as you know, I've spent 15 plus years watching DAM vendors and CMS vendors pitch, pitch buyers. And it's incredible how they don't still to this day, you know, I'd still say the majority of them are too focused on selling rather than asking.
Yeah.
And not taking the time to really understand where is this client. And they're walking in. I'm using metaverse because I just watched somebody do a metaverse pitch. metaverse consulting pitch. So when I think about this, you have to understand what they need now, right? You can't go in and pitch something that's way beyond where they are.
Yeah.
And by the same token, you can't go in and pitch something too sort of elementary if they are ready to start building metaverse applications. Absolutely. So it's really important.
And I think it's important for us marketers with our messaging. I mean, I've actually sat in a room years ago working for a vendor, which was a content management vendor, had a very specific USP, and the CMO decided that they were going to talk about this grand digital experience vision. And I sat in the crowd and I was listening to the sort of feedback, and it was flying over their heads, right? They were, you know, they were content management professionals that understood, you know, componentized content management. And that's what they were there to hear about the future of content management. And there's somebody, you know, just telling them what a CMO wants. And it's like, well, that their whole messaging changed around that. And you lose your core base, don't you, unless you remember the problem that you're solving. But that, and as I say, this is bringing me straight on to what I was going to ask you, because as we've established, you're recognized as one of the top analysts, or as the cool kids would call you, an influencer in this space. And it's our job as B2B marketers to influence you. So what do you make of, I mean, I know some of these things, as you share with me sometimes, some of the stuff that vendors send you, but what do you make of the general level of comms that you get from vendors?
For me,
they're
not targeted to me. I mean, that's part of the problem. Is that I get added to the, of course, I mean, I'm on all these mailing lists, right? I get vendor emails every day, and they're sending me the same things that they're sending prospects and people who are buying their first dam, or it's very rarely targeted to me.
Right. Would these be the same vendors that talk about personalization and digital experience?
Some of them, yes. Some of them, yes. But I would also say it's astonishing to me. This whole idea of influencer is very funny. You know, I still think of myself really as an analyst and a consultant, but influencer, you know, it is. If of course you're trying to convince an influencer, you need to be persuasive, you know, you need to convince them. Right. And, I mean, I don't need another email about the, you know, the value of DAM, you know, that's not what I need, you know, sort of. So I get stuff that's way too basic for me. And sometimes, that said, sometimes I forward it to my clients, you know, who might benefit from more basic information or more, you know, but that's not, that's
well,
not convincing me. Yeah. maybe. But I would also say, the larger vendors who have what I'll call a machine, mm-hmm. you know, whether that's a marketing machine or an analyst relations machine, you know, so this is where, am I allowed to mention vendor names on your podcast? So if I think about, say, Adobe or Sitecore or OpenText, for example, they all have analyst relations machine. You know, they employ analyst relations people, and they are very, they even have very targeted mailings for digital asset management analysts or content management analysts. And I get very, very specific things and I get invited to very specific briefings. Obviously smaller vendors can't parse things necessarily
argue against that. I think that's a question of focus, right? Isn't it?
I guess that's true. I suppose they could, but the question is, do they have the resources to do it, and do they have the data to do it? I think that's the question.
But then I would argue that if you're going to engage with influencers and analysts, you pick them, and then you have a special program that's within your, you know, which is in the bandwidth that you can handle, right? I think it's very important. I mean, I know that the big guys have got the resources and all that kind of stuff, but also I think the little guys could pick somebody like yourself, right? And just really focus, I think.
They could. Yeah. Well, you're the marketer, so you would know.
Well, I'm a big fan of him. The other thing, I think that in B2B, I think we've got a good influencer muscle, if you like, because we've always had to do AR and analyst relations and that kind of stuff. We've always had people that have influenced our market, right? So sure. I advocate for that. Yes. So thank you for that. Yes. Right. So if I move on to, that's a general comms you usually get, but if I move on to the briefings, so I would imagine that a few of the listeners who are in B2B, will be familiar with briefing folks like yourself. Right. And I've had a bit of experience with this when I was an analyst for a short period of time. And I'm sure you could give a lot of advice on that. What's your advice when it comes to briefings?
Well, I would just briefly repeat what I said about the emails. You know, don't tell me what I already know. Don't waste my time. You know, as somebody, my current vendor list that I follow is 52 vendors long. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have a researcher who works for me and helps me keep my research up to date. Yeah. But I don't want to spend, if I meet with each of those vendors at least twice a year, which is my goal. I don't want to spend the first 10, 15 minutes retelling me about, you know, what DAM, yeah. you know, what DAM is or yeah, what yeah. your viewpoint is. Is that, yeah. it's just, but also being a, and I understand, of course, the importance of positioning, the importance of how a vendor is attacking the market or approaching the market, I should say. But what I really want to know is, you know, well, talking about USP, what actually makes you different? You know, what do you think makes you different? Which sometimes it's more what they think makes them different than what actually makes them different. But that's the, I often feel like the beginning is just sort of noise because it's what they pitch to their customers or their prospects, you know? So you have to sell differently or persuade analysts differently than you persuade buyers or than you persuade people who are going to invest in your technology. It's a different level of experience, knowledge, and you know, sort of positioning that you need to do for analysts. And that's what I find. It's like they just mix them up. It's like just the pitch, you know. So
when I do persona work, and you've seen some of this, when I do persona work is I always include the influencer and analyst as a separate persona because they have different needs, as you say.
Absolutely.
Right? So your needs are that you want to hear cool stuff. You want to talk to cool clients that are doing cool things. And you want to know how you can spot us in a crowd, right?
That's right.
Which is incredibly difficult. And I've sat on your side of the table and I remember having to convince, not convince, but like ask in advance that to make sure the vendor was going to give me a demonstration because what I was seeing, I mean, I used to cover WCM and what I was seeing, like you say, was the same shit from everybody.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, what I need is I understand the basics of why one needs to manage one's web content, content assets. What I need to know is how you're doing differently, what you bring to the table and what's the experience like. I mean, the fact that in a briefing, you have to convince, you have to tell somebody, why don't you show me your products? It was baffling to me at the time. Right? So,
well, I think that what's interesting, though, and what I responded to that is that most of them don't actually do it differently from their competitors, right? Exactly. I think that's what they struggle for. You know, that's what they struggle to find is we want to hear that. But then, and this is the case with DAM, most, you know, 90 to 95% of the features of most DAM systems are commodity, you know, and all the vendors do the same thing.
I really think this point is so good because I've always said in my career that when I'm in a vendor, we are the worst people to know what's happening with our competitors. That's why I think vendors should talk to people like you as clients and get your perspective on what's going on in the market, because we just don't know. We think we know, but we don't know where our differentiators are and you have to talk to customers, you have to talk to analysts and find out what it is about that. But there's a reason why somebody purchased your product, and it's teasing that out and sharing that with you, isn't it? You know, this large consumer organization chose our product because of these things. And it might just be they like the service, they like the consultants or whatever it is. But if you know what that is, then you can help with recommending that vendor to other people, can't you?
Absolutely. And it is definitely, to your point, case studies, you know, if I can use that expression or that term, just examples. How are people using the product and what is unique about that? You know, that is the most, tell me a story, you know, we haven't used the word story yet, but you know, tell me a story. And how many times if there's anything I understand about marketing, it's that, right? It's tell me a good story. And that is something that I don't need to hear the story of DAM. You know, I know the story. I need to know the story of how the people used your product in an interesting way. Right. Yeah. That's what I want to hear.
And I was going to say people buy from people because it's such a hackneyed expression, but it's the truth though, isn't it? You don't want to know features and functions. You want to know the why. You want to know what it is what are they bringing to the table? How is it going to look for you when you introduce one of your clients to this group of folks, right? Are they going to embarrass you or how's that going to go?
Yes. It's, the art of sales is, a fascinating thing. We should have a whole separate discussion about that. But
well, that's why, I mean, that's why I think somebody like yourself is important, a resource for everybody in the category, right? Whether you're a client looking to implement a digital asset management solution, or if you're selling into that market, you're uniquely positioned, really, because you can see it from all directions, can't you? So I think I don't need to sell Teresa regularly, but you know.
Thank you, though. I appreciate it.
I'm quite happy to do it. But yeah, and I've played that role in the past as well, and I find that fascinating as what you can see, because when you're inside the vendor, it's very hard to see that sort of the landscape in that broader way. So I've kind of asked you for your advice really on the category, and I've asked you for your advice for people like myself, B2B marketers. But let's have a look at your end clients. So if a listener is looking to change their digital asset management solution or starting out, what's your advice when people are looking at this? What do they need? What are the requirements, and where should they go? What should they do?
Well, I'll go back to when I sort of described what I do myself define your future state. And that is, it's a discovery process, essentially. It's figuring out where do I need to get to. And, the analogy that I sometimes use is, everyone knows, a lot of people know me for my analogies and, and all the metaphors and analogies I use. Yeah. You know, I like to say, we're building, it's like building a smart home. Mm-hmm. You know, so you think about, there's stages to building a house where you have a foundation, you have a framework, you start to build the walls, you put the furniture inside. But you know, maybe that's where we were getting to 10 years ago. But now it's, now we're building all these smart systems within the house, and they're connected, and we want them to be predictive, and we want them to know what the temperature we like, and we want the refrigerator to tell us. So now we're not just building a house where we put all our stuff. That's the old digital asset management. Now we're building a smart, responsive, intelligent ecosystem together. So what I always say to my clients is, okay, you've never had a dam before, or okay, you've had a dam for 15 years. Mm. Okay, where are you trying to get to? And I always say, tell me what you want out of your customer experience, because that's what DAM is supporting today. And if they don't have those use cases, if they don't have that fleshed out, a lot of times I say, go away and do that 3 months, come back, tell me. Because then I'll write your use cases for DAM. You can't write use cases for digital asset management. You can't write requirements for digital asset management without knowing what the overall business goals are, what the overall strategy is, what the overall customer experience
that
is. It's all intertwined.
That North Star.
Exactly.
I like that. And we talk about technology and technology acquisition a bit on this show. We've all been involved in it. And I really like that point that you're making, which is almost like, go away and have a think about it before you come to me or come to market. And too many times we see people say, I need a DAM. They see some demos, they see some shiny things, and the train has left the station and they're off, right? And really, they haven't really considered, well, what are really my requirements? What is it that I actually need? And I think that's a really good point. And do you help clients with that? Are you ever in a situation where it's like, they're like, well, you actually don't need one of these right now, or you need something slightly different. Does that requirements process sometimes throw that up, that they completely change their mind?
It does. I end up about half the time telling them that they wouldn't get any additional benefit from replacing their system.
Right.
I would give that about 50% of all strategies end with, actually, the solution is not to throw this out and buy a new one. It's I would say that the other, 40%, so 50% do need to change their system because it's old, or they haven't upgraded it, or the vendor is sunsetting the solution, whatever all the reasons are they need to replace their system. I would say of the remaining 50%, probably 90% of the rest is some kind of data governance issue that needs to be solved.
Right.
That's a whole other podcast, right? to talk about. So a lot of the work ends up being data orchestration, data alignment, things like that I won't get into too much depth on, but just helping define what's the problem to begin with, really, what is the problem to begin with, and then figure out how to get there. Because to your point, just like vendors who have a hard time really understanding the market they're competing in, or they don't necessarily spend the time to understand the market they're competing in. Yeah. I think when you're inside an organization and you're just trying to keep the wheels going every day, and you're trying to keep the marketing engine going every day, you don't necessarily take the time to understand, you know, the bigger picture. You don't have the time to see the forest for the trees. And so that's what I do.
I like that. I like that where you're saying, because I think that when we think about a technology implementation, we're thinking about the selection and the implementation, and we've got that kind of time boxed or cost boxed or whatever we've got, but we don't include that sort of few months ahead of that, which is requirements gathering and really figuring out what it is that we need, right? Which is the thing that you're talking about there. Once somebody's got to that point and they realize they need to acquire a dam, where do you start with that? Do you then help them with a short list based on the requirements, or how does that process then happen after that?
Sure. I give them a in-depth market overview. I explain who the players are. I explain who has particular experience in their industry vertical. And have a chat. You know, we have an in-depth talk about the market. And it's interesting because it's not necessarily it's not usually a requirements matching exercise anymore.
Yeah.
Because to my point, 95% of dams, they all do the same thing.
Yeah.
It's much more about, is it going to fit into your ecosystem technologically, culturally? Right. You know, who are their implementation partners?
Yeah.
All the pieces that have to do with the best match. It's a matchmaking exercise. I often say that's I'm really a matchmaker. So it's all those pieces, and also just understanding what the organizational dynamic is. I mean, I had a client CEO a couple of weeks ago who said, "Well, I don't want to go with a vendor that I've never heard of. You know, why would I go with a vendor I've never heard of?" And of course, CEO of a big marketing agency, right? So it's these kinds of things that I need to understand what that dynamic is, because these are the forces at play. So it's figuring that out.
And that's an important point actually for B2B marketers, is that brand is important as well.
Absolutely.
If you as the recommender, influencer, analyst is saying to somebody, "These guys are an absolute best fit," and they go, "Who?" it's going to be a much harder push. Even if they're the perfect solution, it's a much harder push for you to get them into that shortlist, right? The other thing that I thought was interesting, actually, that you were saying about just now, which was replacement. I think too often, isn't it, we think that we need to replace the technology that we have in order to do something shiny and new, and often because we've been listening to the vendor hype. I think that was interesting. So you said that it's like 50% of the time it's like, well, the system you have right now is great. Is that because they've not upgraded the system they have, or they've not realized its potential? How does that conversation go?
Yeah, I think it's not so much telling them that the system they have is great. It's more telling them, it's more telling them, you know, what you have could continue to be adequate.
Yep.
You know, let me use that. Let me say it that way.
Yeah.
But you know, you might, for example, need to move from the on-premise version to the SaaS version. You know, that's been a big one for the last, you know, 5-6 years, right? People who've been on these on-premise solutions, they stop upgrading it. And then by then the vendor's re-engineered and it's all SaaS and they haven't moved on. So there's that. But it's also a matter of, you know, occasionally they it's like you buy the house with the big garden, but you're not actually doing anything to establish what the parameters should be and what you've planted and taking care of it and, you know, all the factors that go into that. So, you know, the garden analogy is often overused, but it's so appropriate, you know, where people buy these systems, they spend a lot of money, they put the assets in there, they put metadata, but then they don't have people taking care of it. They don't have a gardener. They don't have a dam manager. And they haven't taken good care. So I always say, you've got this great technology, or you have this adequate technology, depending on where it is, but you're not doing all the things to make it run properly. It's like having a nice car in your driveway or in your you know, and you're not doing anything.
No, I like that analogy, because often marketers overbuy, don't they? And they have this they have this great solution, and then it gets neglected because nobody remembers it's got all these features and functions. And you've really got to try and fall back in love with your vendor again, haven't you? And discover what it is that it can do for you as your needs change.
That's
a great point. All right, I've just realized, Tom, I'm going to get to our final question, Teresa.
Okay.
We have a regular feature, the Rockstar CMO Swim Pool, with our portal to marketing hell, where we throw all the bullshit, snake oil, and overhype trends that plague this industry love. And I know that you've probably got half a dozen that we could throw in here in a review of marketing. What would you chuck into our swim pool?
Well, I think, you know, I'm trying to decide how extreme I want to be. I mean, I think, you know, most marketing is just, like, may I say, most marketing is bullshit. I mean, that's the truth. It's the truth, isn't it? You know, why am I in marketing technology? It's because I love stories. Mm-hmm. You know, I love stories, and I was a journalist. I always wanted to be a storyteller. I always wanted to be a writer. That's how I ended up, completely by accident, I ended up in marketing technology, and it's because I love stories. And, you know, marketing manages to distill most stories into this, you know, tiny little nugget of something that sometimes it's mostly true and a lot of times it's not, you know? So that's my kvetch, is that some days I say to myself, you know, this technology is cool. What I do is really interesting, and I'm glad I have something interesting to do every day with my life. But, you know, sometimes the content itself, I'm like, come on, guys, really? You know, that's what I'm going to throw in there.
Oh, come on. Are you sure it's not industry leading paradigm shifting?
Yeah, but it's not even just how the technology vendors describe themselves. It's sometimes just how any product is. Let me give you an example. Can I give you an example?
Yeah.
You know, brands are all about trying to get customers to identify, you know, and relate to a brand. Yeah. So I can always laugh at the technology vendors, just because it's part of part of my job is to judge their marketing, right? But last week when I was skiing, I was on a gondola, and you know, if I was to give an example of a great brand that I love and that I identify with, there's a brand of skis called Black Crowes, which came out of Chamonix. You know, it's a newer brand. You know, they haven't been around, you know, a very long time, and they had on the side of the ski, it says, "Prenez-moi jusqu'au bout du monde," which means take me to the end of the world, you know? So it's like this whole idea of like, I mean, and I went, wow, that's cool. Because that's how, you know, when I go skiing, that's what I feel like. Like, this is awesome. I am going to my edge. I'm taking myself to new horizons. I'm doing, and all of a sudden I wanted to just grab those skis and, you know, and go, you know? It's not that I'm I'm not against, and of course that's exaggerated. I'm not actually going to the edge of the world, am I? No, not really, but... Still,
it's,
you know,
it's the story. So
it's the story. It's a great story. Yeah, yeah, and it inspired me, you know, just seeing that on the side of the skis inspired me to take a more aggressive run on my next run, you know? So and things like that. It's not that I don't sometimes really love good marketing, but most of the time I think it's silly.
Yeah, I think, you'd get very little of it, don't you, in B2B marketing about that vision, you know, and
that's right.
People being edgy and that kind of stuff. That's brilliant. Well, thank you very much, Teresa. As usual, I've enjoyed our conversation.
As always.
But when people aren't fortunate enough, they can just jump on a train and come and see you in London, and they spin the dial on the interwebs, where are they going to find you?
You can find me at teresaregley.com, and you can find my company at voxveritasdigital.com. So enjoy.
It's splendid. And I'll include all of your links in the show notes. Thank you very much, Teresa. And I look forward to speaking to you soon.
Likewise. Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye.
Thank you, Teresa. Great advice there for whichever side of the marketing technology table you sit on, whether you're a vendor or a buyer. I will, of course, include all of Teresa's links in the show notes. Right, it's that time of the week as I join my friend and content marketing guru, Robert Rose, chief troublemaker at the Content Advisory, for a cocktail and a marketing thought. Good evening, Robert. What are you drinking?
Oh, well, look at the bar. Oh, my goodness gracious. I am, it's hard for me to even, I mean, You are just such a master at making this place over. I think what we have here is, I don't even know what you would call this, a polka festival? It's like a Lithuanian polka festival. There's just all sorts of Lithuanians running around here, and there's polka music playing, and what, this is just fantastic. What a celebratory, wonderful. This is just great.
Who doesn't love a Lithuanian polka festival?
That's right. That's right. If there's ever something I'm trying to do is give you lots and lots of homework in post-production, it is to find the most obscure music that I possibly can. So Lithuanian polka being something that I'm sure you'll be able to easily.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. I mean, it's a popular choice on the jukebox here anyway, right? So it'll be very simple for me to.
I'm sure.
To make us feel like we're absolutely hearing it. Lithuanian polka.
Yeah. Excellent.
Well, once these people calm down with their polka and their festival.
Yes, indeed. We do have a wonderful drink. We actually have an Italian drink that doesn't really match well with the Lithuanian polka playing in the background there, but it's a wonderful, wonderful drink. And it was made famous, actually, by, I don't know if you watched the House. Do you watch the House of the Dragon, the Game of Thrones show?
No, I haven't been watching that.
If you haven't watched Game of Thrones, it's probably worth starting there before you actually go to the prequel. Yeah. But yeah. House of the Dragon is the prequel to the Game of Thrones television show, and it was the star there, Emma Darcy, who I believe is English, made this, put this drink into the spotlight, and it's just a fantastic drink. It's called a Negroni Spagliato. A Negroni Spagliato, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful drink. And of course, it starts with a Negroni, where you have a little bit of Campari, a little bit of sweet vermouth, and then you add a little Prosecco, or really any of your favorite sparkling wine, whatever that may be, and then a little bit of an orange. So it's a drink that'll hit you. And so it's just a lovely, wonderful drink. So you can do this either shaken and put into a martini-like glass, or you can pour it all the ingredients into sort of a highball glass, whichever is your preference. But that is it. Campari, sweetened vermouth, and a little Prosecco, and an orange for garnish, or a little squeeze if you like the juice there, and should be good.
I bet that's some good drinking. I bet that's one of those things where you have three of them and you realize you've had three of them.
That's exactly right. Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to attempt to make that very drink using only the ingredients on my desktop bar. So I'm going to start off with the most English of Camparis and vermouths, gin. In this case, Hendrick's gin. I shall... Oh, ice. Forgot about the ice. You were either shaking or stirring this one, weren't you?
I did it over rocks, so you could do it too.
I would as well, because the Prosecco, you wouldn't normally shake a Prosecco, would you? I
mean, no, you would not shake a Prosecco, typically.
Yeah. All right, and I have asked the lovely people at Fever Tree to assemble the most similar thing they could find to vermouth, Prosecco and Campari. And they said to me, honestly, I talk to them every week, they said to me, why don't you try some cucumber tonic water? They said it's very similar. So I said, oh, thank you very much. Why don't you sponsor the show? They said, no. Oh, so there you go. So this is... I don't know why I mention Fever Tree every bloody week. Anyway, so let's have a taste of this. Mmm. That is delicious, Robert. I could drink one of these every week.
Ah,
what are we calling it?
Well, that is the Negroni Spagliato.
Nice. I've got a bit of the Spagliato. I've got less of the Negroni in mine.
Yes. Negroni Spagliato.
I love it. And where are you going to whisk us away to drink these?
Well, we went to the Amalfi Coast last week.
Oh.
But I'm going to take us to a completely different location this week. Mm-hmm. So we are going to head, and this is going to sound just completely non sequitur, but it's been someplace where I wanted to go because it continues to be rainy here in Southern California. So we're going to head to my home state of Texas, and we're going to head to a little town called San Antonio. There is a Mexican restaurant there And I guess it would be a good place to have Negroni Spagliatos called La Margarita. I probably should have had margaritas, but nonetheless, we will go to La Margarita, which is one of the most famous Mexican restaurants on all of the Riverwalk in San Antonio. And it is just a fantastic place to sit outside, have just tons of Mexican food, and contemplate everything. Fun fact, the La Margarita restaurant is the place where they invented the fajita. So there you go. Tex-Mex at its finest.
It wasn't invented in Mexico. Oh, that's...
No. Oh, no. Man. No, no. Yeah.
If there's one thing that I miss about not living in the US, it is the Mexican food. Just love it. I mean, we just don't get, you know, it's, the thing with the quality of, I mean, you're probably got the discerning taste where you can say, oh, then this is rubbish Mexican food, or this is great Mexican food. For us, everything is great Mexican food there, right?
Compared to here,
you know, so fantastic.
There is a place that I went to. Where was it? It was in London, and it was up in the posh.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've been to some nice Mexican restaurants in London, but what I'm saying is, and it's an event, whereas there, you know, your cornerstone and your corner Mexican restaurant or whatever, you just have a great time, few bucks, good beer, just great, you know, whole range. I'm sure it'll come to you where that rents, but there are a few in London for sure. So where were we? We're in San Antonio. We're in this Mexican restaurant, and we're confusing the people by not drinking tequila or ranch roses. We're drinking Negronis. When conversation turns to marketing, what are we talking about this week?
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about how we get beyond the form of content. It's an interesting challenge.
Evolution of last week and the week before.
An evolution of last week, if you will. Yes, indeed. Yes, you know, if we started with content last week, which is really about the idea. I mean, literally the content of our content. And it is the idea that we are trying to express.
Yes.
And in many ways, what we do in marketing is to start with the form. In other words, and it's natural for us, right? Because if you think about it, it's the way we get inspired, right? When we, and the way we get inspired is we're consuming content. We're all consumers of content. Mm-hmm. When we look at a video or listen to a podcast or see a print ad or see a great email, that's how we're inspired. And so that's where our brain starts, is we go, wow, I want to do that. Yeah. Right. I want to come up with an idea for a great podcast. I want to come up with a great idea for a thing.
Yeah.
And you start there. You see this excellent creative idea expressed in some form factor, and you go, that's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. It's normal to do this. Yeah. And by the way, we not only do it in business, but we do it, the other, you know, artists do it as well. And if you, I mean, think about it for a second, you know, George Lucas, when he dreamt up a story about a young boy on a desert planet who reunites with his separated at birth twin sister to save the galaxy from an evil empire. Yeah. He didn't start there. He started with, I want to make an amazing movie that's like Buck Rogers, right? Mm-hmm. And he said, I want to make a movie. And when he made the movie, he said, what can I fill that movie with? And he said, I know what I can do. I can dream up this story about a young kid who saves the galaxy in a rebellion. And that's when the idea for Star Wars became a movie. And so it can make sense for filmmakers or for TV show creators or for novelists or for whatever it is, but it doesn't work well for us in marketing.
Yeah.
Because if we start thinking about containers first, the reason that ends up being a heap of trouble for us is because the content isn't an endpoint. In other words, the difference between a movie like Star Wars or a book or a, you know, something like that is that's the end that you're making. That's what you want people to experience.
Yeah.
And in marketing, it's not that way. It's a bridge to an endpoint, which of course is our product or service or what you're trying to hire us to do.
Yeah.
And so we're not trying to optimize for that end experience. So people, and the key is, why do people watch it? The other thing we have to keep in mind is that when we think about content in a marketing perspective, mm-hmm. people aren't clamoring for it, right? People want Star Wars. They're not necessarily wanting to find our marketing content. So conveying one story or one idea in multiple containers gives us a much better chance to find an audience who might appreciate that content if it's marketing based.
Yeah.
You're telling the story everywhere the audience is rather than trying to lure them in to one tentpole piece called a movie or a record or whatever it's going to be.
Yeah.
And so the other reason to basically start with the idea first instead of the container in marketing is because you just see so many great, big, wonderful ideas get trapped in small, tiny little containers. I mean, how many times have you seen like amazing, you know, amazingly replete white papers, you know, like 7,000 words. And if the idea is like, really, this is what you spent 7,000 words talking about? I mean, goodness gracious, a small idea. You know, on the other hand, you might see a blog post and you're like, holy crap, this is an amazing idea. You need another 5,000 words to tell this story, right?
Yeah.
And so you get a lot of loss. You know, you leave a lot on the table, as it were, when you start thinking of form first, because great ideas get trapped in small packages and poor ideas get trapped in big packages. And so if we can start creating the ideas, the story first, then think about all of the different experiences and containers that we want it to be in. And that's a hard thing for marketers to do, you know, even down to, you know, like, I talk to many content teams and the request for content that is on their intranet or, you know, sends an email or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. The request is, oh, you want a piece of content. You're in demand gen, you're in sales and, you know, you're in wherever part of the organization you want content. You go to that form on the intranet and what's the first drop down menu? What do you want? Do you want an ebook? Do you want a white paper? Do you want whatever? So you pick the form and then you go, okay, what's the creative brief for this thing? What are you trying to make it say? And instead, if you literally just change that form to what's your idea? We'll talk about containers down the road. We'll talk about what that means. But you know, what you're asking for really is the expression of an idea. And that's what's important, is the expression of the idea. You can always figure out what the appropriate containers are for it later. That's a different way of thinking and a different way of starting your content marketing process.
Yeah, and I also think in this as well is that where you were talking about big ideas in small packages is the problem. I think sometimes a team will say, no, we've done that. And you're like, well, yeah, you might have done it and you will remember it and you might be bored with the fact that you did one ebook about this particularly big topic, but the audience hasn't. There may be more scope for sharing it with the audience, and the audience needs to read it, needs to find it, needs it in different forms or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's so easy to say, oh, we've got to produce this month's ebook. Let's look at the ideas board. Oh, we've done that one. And then the idea is never, you don't revisit that idea. Whereas, like you say, some ideas are bigger and better than others, right? So
that's right.
Yeah. And is that the sort of thing? And that's the kind of work you do, isn't it, with your clients, is try and walk them back to that. How do you do that with people? Because we are so hardwired to, like you say, the first thing in a content intake form is, what is it you want, i.e. form. How do you then
walk, right, what's the,
yeah, how do you right. walk that back with your clients?
Well, it's usually not too hard to get agreement from, you know, so remember, we're primarily working with marketing and content teams. So usually that is a very welcome idea, which is either include us in the thinking about what form it should take, or certainly don't make the judgment now. We got to get the idea right first. And that goes back to what we talked about last week on the show, where we talked about the idea of that integrated marketing communication starts with the idea, the content first, and then we can start thinking about how we're going to construct a promotional element around those ideas. But that for when we're, you know, when we are in a content team that our job is to produce digital assets for various parts of the business, you know, that internal agency model, there's usually great acceptance of, oh yes, we definitely want that. We want to be able to change that. Tell us your idea and then we'll figure out the forms. What's harder is to get people to want different, you know, the people who are requesting those things to do it differently.
Right.
Because for them, they've already got it worked out in their head how they're going to promote it, right? Or how they're going to use it.
Yeah.
You know, they've and that's one of the biggest challenges is, you know, you've got a sales enablement team or a sales team or a demand gen team or even senior leadership or whoever. When they go fill out that form or put in that request for an ebook or a white paper, in their head, they've already worked it all out, right? And so making them either spell all that out or frankly go, you may not have the greatest idea there, you know, basically just right for right now, let's just stick with what your idea is. And then we'll figure out if you've got it all figured out or you don't. That is a harder thing because everybody, you know, I mean, this is a classic that's been true forever. Everybody's got two jobs, theirs in marketing, but the job that you, those others that feel like they're in marketing is all about how I'm going to do this cool thing, like how I'm going to take this cool thing and make it, you know, and use it, right? In other words, give me a bright, shiny thing that I want, and then I'll, don't worry, I'll take care of the rest of it, right? That's, you know, as I often say, you walk, if you're a marketing guy, walk around the office with a, you know, with an Excel spreadsheet and go, let's talk about process or the analytics or the efficiency of how we're working through these processes and see how many people show up to your meeting. And then, but then walk around with the new website comps or what the email should look like or what this new white paper should look like. And everybody will come and have 10 cents to offer.
No, I love that. And I was laughing before the punchline there because I knew exactly what you were going to say. And you're so right with that. I mean, everybody wants to get involved in the creative and nobody wants to get involved with the process for sure.
Everybody wants to be in the expression of the idea, but not think too hardly about the idea itself.
Absolutely. And I think, but I also really like this idea that you were saying earlier about this, the fact that bigger, small ideas can then be in these big packages, like you say. Like I've even seen in business books, you sort of read the beginning of it and you think, right, okay, so this is the idea of the book, and then you realize the whole book is just like repeating it or proving that point. And it's a very thin idea that really didn't need a book. It was probably a blog post.
Don't even get me started on business books. I mean, you know, for the most part, you get the main thrust of any of most modern business books if you read the introduction, right? If you, and probably the first chapter. If you read the introduction to the first chapter, you've got it. It's kind of done at that point. The rest of the book is sort of either repeating that or talking through how Jane made it happen in her company, and here's how she made it happen in her company, and you know, which is kind of useless to you, but it's
feels,
you
know, like a book.
It fills out 40,000 words that they still need to finish a book. And so it, many business books are small ideas captured in a big thing.
But we also do the same thing in marketing. Like you say, there'll be a white paper and actually it should have been a blog post. And similarly, there might be a blog post that actually should be a fully integrated campaign and do all the things, right?
I mean, and that gets to a goals and objectives, right? You know, I mean, that is, that is, it is, you know, it's funny because those two things are often not in lockstep with each other, right? And that does go back to our conversation last week, which is people start requesting stuff just because they, you know, they're literally driving in from their home to the office. And they go, oh my gosh, wouldn't it be awesome to have a thought leadership paper on, you know, blah, or they hear it on a podcast or they hear it. We should have a, you know, we should have a thing, right? You know, I can remember back in the day, I used to use the analogy of the, of, you know, it's a little dated now, but I used to use the analogy of the CEO walking in, you know, in the early, this is the early days of social media, right? When the CEO would walk in and slap down the airline magazine that they just read on the marketer's desk and go, where are we on this whole social media stuff? right?
Yeah.
And and you're like, you're a marketer going, ah, you know, you just big sigh, right? It's like, okay, you know, we're thinking about it, right? Just you know, slow down, champ, right?
Yeah, we're on it. I love that. I love that analogy. And I think I've used it in my writing, but it is dated. But that sort of management by airline magazine.
Right. And, it's you hear it all the time now, right? Yeah, I mean, how many times do we hear from companies, and this is a general course, literally like a Greek chorus in a musical, right? It's literally, we need video.
Yeah.
We need more video. Yeah. We need video. Yeah. We need video. Yeah. We need, it's like, tell me what's in the video. Like, you know, what do you mean by that? What does video mean? Well, we just need more video. We just need more video on our site. We need more video on our social media channels. We just need more video.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What are the ideas that you're trying to? I don't care. We just need more video. Yeah. Okay, now we know we have an issue.
Yeah, what's our TikTok strategy?
Yeah.
All right, mate. So when people are looking for advice on not adding more video to their websites, where are they going to find you?
Well, you know, you can find us at contentadvisory.net, where we have not a lot of video, actually. Yeah.
Very good. And when people...
We have some.
When people spin the dial on the interwebs and they're looking for you, where are they going to find you?
They're going to find me primarily on LinkedIn, but I'm slowly coming back to Twitter. yes, I am starting to tweet again. I'm reactivating my activity there. I'm not sure what to say about myself, whether I'm sort of kowtowing in or just, you know, because here's what I found. I found that there are lots of great people on Twitter, and I've got lots of great connections there, and I get asked questions, I get added and added to tweets, in a way it's like I should either just quit it entirely and not be there, or I need to participate, because it's not fair to those who are adding me and adding me to conversations to just be silent on it. So we'll see how it turns out. But I think that's the, because I don't want to go off it completely. I don't want to completely delete my account. I don't find it that onerous at the moment. But nor do I really enjoy sort of what Elon is doing to all those folks. But
And I think it's a different place in it, Twitter at the moment. The engagement has certainly dropped, I think.
Well, it's interesting. My feed has changed for the worse and the better. And what I mean by that is that my feed has definitely changed for the worse, in the sense that the algorithm has no doubt changed to more politics and more stuff that I just don't want to see, including Elon, by the way. But it's changed for the better, in that the conversations that I'm seeing happen are a little better. In other words, my network that I have cultivated over the last number of years, the conversations are great. Like the value of the content getting shared is good. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword, really. Now, you know, less noise for sure. And from my network, and better conversations, but at the same time, more nonsense.
That sounds like it sums up Twitter. So when you're, if you wanted more noise and more nonsense, are you going to be in the bar next week?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, hopefully with more of this polka, that's got to bring us out. We got to bring us out with some great polka music.
All right, mate. I'll see you then. Have a good one. Cheers, buddy. Bye-bye. Thank you, Robert. I'll include all of those links in the show notes. Please stop by and check out his work. So that's a wrap on episode 158 of the Rockstar CMO Effing Marketing Podcast. Thanks to Teresa and Robert for sharing their insight, and to you for dropping a dime into your podcasting jukebox, selecting our track and jiving along with us. Please let us know what you think. You can contact us through our website, rockstarcmo.com. Catch us on the socials. We are RockstarCMO just about everywhere. Or leave a rating or review in your favourite podcast app. Or just keep listening. I'm glad you're here. Next week, Jeff Clark is back with his marketing studio. I go backstage with a fascinating young entrepreneur, Yash Chavan. And I'll again wind down the week with Robert Rose and the Rockstar CMO Virtual Bar. Until then, have a great week, and I hope you again join us here next week on Rockstar CMO FM.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.